Chapter 11. Royas vos mavoir humilii por mavoir apres que la terre tornador du salil? G vos jure que g ni menestum pas moins. Fontenelle. Plurlight de mons. That lofty criticism had caused Gwendolyn a new sort of pain. She would not have chosen to confess how unfortunate she thought herself in not having had Miss Arrowpoint's musical advantages, so as to be able to question Herr Klezmer's taste with the confidence of thorough knowledge. Still less, to admit even to herself that Miss Arrowpoint each time they met, raised an unwonted feeling of jealousy in her. Not in the least, because she was an heiress, but because it was really provoking that a girl whose appearance you could not characterize except by saying that her figure was slight and of middle stature, her features small, her eyes tolerable, and her complexion sallow, had nevertheless a certain mental superiority which could not be explained away an exasperating thoroughness in her musical accomplishment, a fastidious discrimination in her general tastes, which made it impossible to force her admiration, and kept you in awe of her standard. This insignificant-looking young lady of 24, whom anyone's eyes would have passed over negligently, if as he had not been Miss Arrowpoint, might be suspected of a secret opinion that Miss Harleth's acquirements were rather of a common order, and such an opinion was not made agreeable to think of by being always veiled under a perfect kindness of manner. But Gwendolyn did not like to dwell on facts which threw an unfavorable light on itself. The musical magus who had so suddenly widened her horizon was not always on the scene, and his being constantly backward and forward between London and Quetcham soon began to be thought of as offering opportunities for converting him to a more admiring state of mind. Meanwhile, in the manifest pleasure her singing gave at Brackenshaw Castle, the Firs, and elsewhere, she recovered her equanimity, being disposed to think approval more trustworthy than objection, and not being one of the exceptional persons who have a parching thirst for a perfection undemanded by their neighbors. Perhaps it would have been rash to say then that she was at all exceptional inwardly, or that the unusual in her was more than her rare grace of movement and bearing, and a certain daring which gave piquancy to a very common egoistic ambition, such as exists under many clumsy exteriors, and is taken no notice of. For I suppose that the set of the head does not really determine the hunger of the inner self for supremacy. It only makes a difference sometimes, as to the way in which the supremacy is held attainable, and a little also to the degree in which it can be attained, especially when the hungry one is a girl, whose passion for doing what is remarkable as an ideal limit in consistency with the highest breeding and perfect freedom from the sordid need of income. Gwendolyn was as inwardly rebellious against the restraints of family conditions, and as ready to look through obligations into her own fundamental want of feeling for them, as if as he had been sustained by the boldest speculations. But she really had no such speculations, and would at once have marked herself off from any sort of theoretical or practically reforming women by satirizing them. She rejoiced to feel herself exceptional. But her horizon was that of the genteel romance, where the heroine's soul poured out in her journal is full of vague power, originality, and general rebellion, while her life moves strictly in the sphere of fashion, and if she wanders into a swamp, the pathos lies partly, so to speak, in her having on her satin shoes. Here is a restraint which nature and society have provided on the pursuit of striking adventure. So that a soul burning with a sense of what the universe is not, and ready to take all existence as fuel, is nevertheless held captive by the ordinary wirework of social forms, and does nothing particular. This commonplace result was what Gwendolyn found herself threatened with even in the novelty of the first winter at Offenden. What she was clear upon was that she did not wish to lead the same sort of life as ordinary young ladies did. But what she was not clear upon was how she should set about leading any other, and what were the particular acts which she would assert her freedom by doing. Offenden remained a good background, if anything would happen there, but on the whole the neighborhood was in fault. Beyond the effect of her beauty on a first presentation, there was not much excitement to be got out of her earliest invitations, and she came home after little sallies of satire and knowingness, such as had offended Mrs. Arrowpoint, to fill the intervening days with the most girlish devices. The strongest assertion she was able to make of her individual claims was to leave out Alice's lessons on the principle that Alice was more likely to excel in ignorance, and to employ her with Miss Mary, and the maid who was understood to wait on all the ladies, in helping to arrange various dramatic costumes which Gwendolyn pleased herself with having in readiness for some future occasions of acting in charades or theatrical pieces, occasions which she meant to bring about by force of will or contrivance. As he had never acted, only made a figure in tableau vivants at school, but she felt assured that she could act well, and having been once or twice to the theater francaise, and also heard her mama speak of Rachel, her waking dreams and cogitations as to how she would manage her destiny sometimes turned on the question whether she would become an actress like Rachel, since she was more beautiful than that thin Jewess. Meanwhile, the wet days before Christmas were passed pleasantly in the preparation of costumes, Greek, Oriental, and composite, in which Gwendolyn attitudinized and speechified before a domestic audience, including even the housekeeper, who was once pressed into it that she might swell the notes of applause. But having shown herself unworthy by observing that Miss Harleth looked far more like a queen in her own dress than in that baggy thing with her arms all bare, she was not invited a second time. "Do I look as well as Rachel, Mama?" said Gwendolyn, one day when S.E. had been showing herself in her Greek dress to Anna, and going through scraps of scenes with much tragic intention. "You have better arms than Rachel," said Mrs. Davilow. "Your arms would do for anything, Gwen. But your voice is not so tragic as hers. It is not so deep." "I can make it deeper, if I like," said Gwendolyn, provisionally. Then she added, with decision, "I think a higher voice is more tragic. It is more feminine. And the more feminine a woman is, the more tragic it seems when she does desperate actions." "There may be something in that," said Mrs. Davilow, languidly. "But I don't know what good there is in making one's blood creep. And if there is anything horrible to be done, I should like it to be left to the men." "Oh, Mama, you are so dreadfully prosaic. As if all the great poetic criminals were not women. I think the men are poor cautious creatures." "Well, dear, and you who are afraid to be alone in the night, I don't think you would be very bold in crime, thank God." "I am not talking about reality, Mama," said Gwendolyn, impatiently. Then her mama being called out of the room, she turned quickly to her cousin, as if taking an opportunity, and said, "Anna, do ask my uncle to let us get up some charades at the rectory. Mr. Middleton and Warham could act with us just for practice. Mama says it will not do to have Mr. Middleton consulting and rehearsing here. He is a stick, but we could give him suitable parts. Do ask, or else I will." "Oh, not till Rex comes. He is so clever, and such a dear old thing, and he will act Napoleon looking over the sea. He looks just like Napoleon. Rex can't do anything." "I don't in the least believe in your Rex, Anna," said Gwendolyn, laughing at her. "He will turn out to be like those wretched blue and yellow watercolors of his which you hang up in your bedroom and worship." "Very well, you will see," said Anna. "It is not that I know what is clever, but he has got a scholarship already, and Papa says he will get a fellowship, and nobody is better at games. He is cleverer than Mr. Middleton, and everybody but you call Mr. Middleton clever. So he may be in a dark lantern sort of way. But he is a stick. If he had to say, 'Perdition catch my soul, but I do love her,' apostrophe, he would say it in just the same tone as, 'Here ends the second lesson.'" "Apostrophe, oh, Gwendolyn," said Anna, shocked at these promiscuous allusions. "And it is very unkind of you to speak so of him, for he admires you very much. I heard Warham say one day to Mama, 'Middleton is regularly spoony upon Gwendolyn.'" ... She was very angry with him. But I know what it means. It is what they say at college for being in love. How can I help it? Said Gwendolyn, rather contemptuously. Perdition catch my soul, if I love him, no, of course. Papa, I think, would not wish it. And he is to go away soon. But it makes me sorry when you ridicule him. What shall you do to me when I ridicule Rex? Said Gwendolyn, wickedly. Now, Gwendolyn, dear, you will not, said Anna, her eyes filling with tears. I could not bear it. But there really is nothing in him to ridicule. Only you may find out things. For no one ever thought of laughing at Mr. Middleton before you. Everyone said he was nice looking, and his manners perfect. I am sure I have always been frightened at him, because of his learning, and his square-cut coat, and his being a nephew of the bishop's, and all that. But you will not ridicule Rex, promise me. Anna ended with a beseeching look which touched Gwendolyn. You are a dear little cause, she said, just touching the tip of Anna's chin with her thumb and forefinger. I don't ever want to do anything that will vex you. Especially if Rex is to make everything come off charades and everything. And when at last Rex was there, the animation he brought into the life of Offenden and the rectory, and his ready partnership in Gwendolyn's plans, left her no inclination for any ridicule that was not of an open and flattering kind, such as he himself enjoyed. He was a fine open-hearted youth, with a handsome face strongly resembling his father's and Anna's, but softer in expression than the one, and larger in scale than the other. A bright, healthy, loving nature, enjoying ordinary innocent things, so much that vice had no temptation for him, and what he knew of it lay too entirely in the outer courts, and little visited chambers of his mind for him to think of it with great repulsion. Vicious habits were with him, what some fellows did to put stuff which he liked to keep aloof from. He returned Anna's affection as fully as could be expected of a brother whose pleasures apart from her were more than the sum total of hers, and he had never known a stronger love. The cousins were continually together at the one house, or the other chiefly at Offenden, where there was more freedom, or rather where there was a more complete sway for Gwendolyn. And whatever she wished, became a ruling purpose for Rex. The charades came off according to her plans, and also some other little scenes not contemplated by her in which her acting was more impromptu. It was at Offenden that the charades and tableau were rehearsed and presented, Mrs. Davilow seeing no objection even to Mr. Middleton's being invited to share in them, now that Rex too was there especially as his services were indispensable. Warham, who was studying for India with a Winchester coach, having no time to spare, and being generally dismal under a cram of everything except the answers needed at the forthcoming examination, which might disclose the welfare of our Indian Empire, to be somehow connected with a quotable knowledge of Brown's pastorals. Mr. Middleton was persuaded to play various grave parts, Gwendolyn having flattered him on his enviable immobility of countenance, and at first a little pained, and jealous at her comradeship with Rex, he presently drew encouragement from the thought that this sort of cousinly familiarity excluded any serious passion. Indeed, he occasionally felt that her more formal treatment of himself was such a sign of favor as to warrant his making advances before he left Pennicott, though he had intended to keep his feelings in reserve until his position should be more assured. Miss Gwendolyn, quite aware that she was adored by this unexceptionable young clergyman with pale whiskers and square-cut collar, felt nothing more on the subject than that as he had no objection to being adored. She turned her eyes on him with calm mercilessness, and caused him many mildly agitating hopes, by seeming always to avoid dramatic contact with him for all meanings, we know, depend on the key of interpretation. Some persons might have thought beforehand that a young man of Anglican leanings, having a sense of sacredness much exercised on small things as well as great, rarely laughing save from politeness, and in general regarding the mention of spades by their naked names as rather coarse, would not have seen a fitting bride for himself in a girl who was daring in ridicule, and showed none of the special grace required in the clergyman's wife. Or, that a young man informed by theological reading, would have reflected, that he was not likely to meet the taste of a lively, restless young lady like Miss Harleth. But are we always obliged to explain why the facts are not what some persons thought beforehand? The apology lies on their side, who had that erroneous way of thinking. As for Rex, who would possibly have been sorry for poor Middleton, if he had been aware of the excellent curate's inward conflict, he was too completely absorbed in a first passion to have observation for any person or thing. He did not observe Gwendolyn. He only felt what she said or did, and the back of his head seemed to be a good organ of information as to whether she was in the room or out. Before the end of the first fortnight he was so deeply in love that it was impossible for him to think of his life except as bound up with Gwendolyn's. He could see no obstacles. Poor boy, his own love seemed a guarantee of hers, since it was one with the unperturbed delight in her image, so that he could no more dream of her giving him pain than an Egyptian could dream of snow. She sang and played to him whenever he liked, was always glad of his companionship in writing, though his borrowed steeds were often comic, was ready to join in any fun of his, and showed a right appreciation of Anna. No mark of sympathy seemed absent. That because Gwendolyn was the most perfect creature in the world she was to make a grand match, had not occurred to him. He had no conceit, at least not more than goes to make up the necessary gum and consistence of a substantial personality. It was only that in the young bliss of loving he took Gwendolyn's perfection as part of that good which had seemed one with life to him, being the outcome of a happy, well-embodied nature. One incident which happened in the course of their dramatic attempts impressed Rex as a sign of her unusual sensibility. It showed an aspect of her nature which could not have been preconceived by anyone who, like him, had only seen her habitual fearlessness in active exercises and her high spirits in society. After a good deal of rehearsing, it was resolved that a select party should be invited to attend and to witness the performances which went with so much satisfaction to the actors. Anna had caused a pleasant surprise. Nothing could be neater than the way in which she played her little parts. One would even have suspected her of hiding much sly observation under her simplicity. And Mr. Middleton answered very well by not trying to be comic. The main source of doubt and retardation had been Gwendolyn's desire to appear in her Greek dress. No word for a charade would occur to her either waking or dreaming that suited her purpose of getting a statuesque pose in this favorite costume. To choose a motive from Racine was of no use, since Rex and the others could not declaim French verse, and improvised speeches would turn the scene into burlesque. Besides, Mr. Gaskin prohibited the acting of scenes from plays. He usually protested against the notion that an amusement which was fitting for everyone else was unfitting for a clergyman. But he would not in this matter overstep the line of decorum as drawn in that part of Wessex, which did not exclude a sanction of the young people's acting charades in his sister-in-law's house, a very different affair from private theatricals in the full sense of the word. Everybody, of course, was concerned to satisfy this wish of Gwendolyn's, and Rex proposed that they should wind up with a tableau in which the effect of Her Majesty would not be marred by anyone's speech. This pleased her thoroughly, and the only question was the choice of the tableau. "Something pleasant, children, I beseech you," said Mrs. Davilow. "I can't have any Greek wickedness." "It is no worse than Christian wickedness, Mama," said Gwendolyn, whose mention of Rachelesque heroines had called forth that remark. "And less scandalous," said Rex. "Besides, one thinks of it as all gone by and done with. What do you say to Briseis being led away? I would be Achilles, and you would be looking round at me after the print we have at the rectory." "That would be a good attitude for me," said Gwendolyn, in a tone of acceptance. But afterward she said with decision, "No. It will not do. There must be three men in proper costume, else it will be ridiculous. I have it, said Rex, after a little reflection. H. Hermione as the statue in Winter's Tale? I will be Leance, and Miss Mary, Paulina, one on each side. Our dress won't signify, he went on laughingly. It will be more Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.